This is Ron Orrell, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast, and I'm super excited today to be speaking with two experts in the activism field, Ethan Klinsberg and Elizabeth Bieber, both partners at Freshfields. Ethan has advised corporations against a who's who of activist investors, including Horvex, Elliott, Franklin Mutual, Carl Icahn, Jana Partners, John Paulson, Pershing Square, Relational, Starboard, and Trian. And Elizabeth has worked with numerous companies facing high-profile activism insurgencies and hostile bid situations, including Family Dollar, Acme, Tiffany, United Natural Foods, and Euronav. And we've written probably countless articles on all those situations. So thank you, Ethan and Lisa, for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I'm really excited about today's conversation, and we have a number of interesting topics. And I wanted to start with consultants. And wondering if you could talk a little about what's going on with activist managers pushing for boards to engage consulting groups. Seems to be part of the playbook for Elliott Management's Jesse Cohen and others. And Lisa, you suggested there was a recent Goodyear settlement with Elliott that had a charter provision giving a committee the power to select a management consultant to advise the panel. So explain to me what that's all about, and wondering if there's a danger for companies agreeing to this kind of request.
Sure. So in the Goodyear example that you just cited, one of the things that was agreed to was the creation of a strategic operations and review committee. And as you said, part of what was included in the form of charter that was included in the settlement itself was an agreement that the committee will select a management consultant. And the idea here is that the activist comes in with a thesis and they have good ideas, and they also talk to folks like consultants and can, as part of their negotiations with the company, suggest that if you don't believe us or you want to know more about our ideas, well, let's just ask a consultant. And so the company then brings in a consultant, and the consultant typically works with the board or committee, and they have all of these good ideas that aren't necessarily vetted by management. And so that's where the danger is in acceding to the request, is that you end up with a consultant who's in on the scene. What we've seen time and time again is that activists sometimes have good ideas that the company has already considered or management says is not feasible for one reason or another. And bringing in a consultant to endorse the ideas that management have said are not feasible is another way that activists can functionally drive a wedge between management and the board.
I would go even a step farther and say, a lot of these management consultants know that the activists are a tremendous source of business for them. I mean, Right. They've seen this over the last few years. And so there's almost basically a tacit agreement going on where they know that they will get brought in again and again if they basically go in and advocate the activist playbook for what the activist is seeking operationally, even if management is not endorsing that. And so that's why when we face these situations, it's really important. Sometimes a consultant can be useful, but we push for is to make sure that management selects the consultant and that management oversees the consultant. Because what you don't want to have happen is a situation which we've witnessed where you have some new directors come in, the new directors dominate a committee, which is bringing in the consultant, and then all of a sudden, the consultant's talking about ideas which don't have any connection to what's practical or realistic. And then it creates a situation where there's a clash between the board and management because the board's drinking the Kool-Aid that the consultant is feeding them, and that the source of the consultants taking that approach is because the activist is pushing them to do so. And the consultant will be very responsive because of what I view as a tacit understanding between the activists and the consultants, that the consultants will always be pushing what the activists want for as far as operational reforms.
That's fascinating. So basically, let's say a scenario where a subcommittee dominated by activist-backed candidates picks the management consultant, and that kind of gives the activist and their, let's say, M&A ideas leverage against the board and against the management team. And what kind of management consultant are we talking about? Like Bain, McKinsey, or are there certain consultants that activists really seek out, or I guess depends on the situation?
I think there's a number of consultants who, you know, it depends what industry you're in, et cetera, but there's a number of consultants out there who have been referred over and over again by some of the activists. And will come in and talk about, oh, you know, you should be able to launch this new initiative in e-commerce, or you should be able to cut costs by doing something some way. You should be able to change retail by rearranging your stores a certain way. You should be, you know, ideas that, remember, that's overlooking the whole informational advantage that management has. Management's living with the facts on the ground all the time. Management's incentivized to do the right thing. And then you have these folks come in who are not working with management. They're working with these new directors, and you could have a very unproductive disconnect between reality and what's being pushed for. And that's, unfortunately, a lot of activists are in love with that idea because it creates turbulence, and they see it as a way of flushing out management and suppressing management. And it's just not always in the best interest of the shareholders to do that.
Yeah, it's really quite interesting because, you know, something as a reporter, I guess, I have to keep careful track of, is it the subcommittee that has two out of the four members are activists back that picks the manager's consultant or the consultant, or is it the management team that picks the consultant? That's something I'm going to have to keep an eye out for in the future. But also, I guess, part of the charters for these subcommittees. So I guess this topic of consultants segues very nicely to the next topic I wanted to talk about, a related topic, which is about board subcommittees. And, you know, as we're just chatting, you know, activists frequently seek and succeed in getting new board subcommittees set up when they settle with companies. Almost every situation where there's a settlement, adding some activist-backed directors to the board, and there's also a subcommittee set up, some or all of those activist-backed director candidates get to be on the subcommittee that is formed as part of the agreement. And so, for example, we wrote about Bloomin' Brands struck yet another settlement with an activist, Starboard, this time in January. You'll add two directors to the board and establish a new committee tasked with recommending opportunities for corporate and operational improvement. And at the end of December, another company, BioMarin, settled with Elliott for three seats and a new strategic and operating review committee to evaluate the business strategy, operations, financial, and capital allocation priorities. Quite a mouthful. I feel like these subcommittees are getting longer and longer titles. And I suspect that there's always a battle. Well, I don't know. Maybe you could tell me this, Lisa. Is there a battle between the activists and the company over what the subcommittees should be called? And I guess that relates to what they should be doing. And I feel like behind the scenes, it doesn't matter what the subcommittee's name is, unless it's like a very specific, like CEO search subcommittee. That's clearly to look for CEO. But these operational improvement subcommittees, I feel like there's a subtext. Maybe the activist wants the subcommittee to focus on M&A. Sometimes there are strategic review subcommittees that's really focused on M&A. But I feel like the goal is to give the activist-backed directors a larger role in key decision-making. You feel like that work this is making by setting up these subcommittees and putting their people on the board, on the committees? I guess so. What is the role of the subcommittee and who picks the name of it?
Yeah. So, Ron, I think you touched on, in your intro, some really interesting facets that go on. So one, I think the name does really become part of the negotiation. And the truth is that when an activist comes in and you're engaging in a settlement, everything is subject to negotiation. We just talked about management consultants, even whether to have a consultant as part of the negotiation. But when you talk about committees, who goes on the committee is certainly part of that negotiation. And almost always there will be at least one of the new directors on. But the name of the committee also becomes really important because you said it, that sometimes these committees are strategic review committees. Very often, we all know that part of the goal of activism is to catalyze M&A in more than half of activist engagements. And a lot of companies don't want to necessarily put a target on their back by calling a committee a strategic review committee. They're not there yet. They don't know if they want to sell. They may not want to sell. And so there's certainly, when you talk about a strategic and operating review committee, that sounds a little bit better than a strategic review committee. Or if it's an operating review committee, those just sound like the company is not immediately for sale. But the other thing that you touched on that I think is important to think about is exactly the breadth of the mandates for these committees. One that you cited from BioMarin, it starts to sound a lot like the duties of the board, doesn't it? When you're talking about business strategy, operation, it's everything. And you're consolidating that power and that control in a very small number of people, including, as Ethan mentioned earlier, folks who may be very new to the board, who are coming in, they're new directors. They may be appointed by the activist. They may be someone from an activist fund. And they are essentially being delegated some of the really key responsibilities that fall to the full board.
Just to add on to Lisa's points, I mean, we often take the position that the only reason to form a committee is if there's a new committee is if there's a conflict. And when we're talking about the best interests of the shareholders and what operational reforms to make or whether you should sell the company, unless somebody on the board or in management is going to be the buyer of the company, there should be no conflict, right? And there's no reason to start dividing up the board and trying to create dissension within the board. And so generally, we advise strongly against forming these committees because there's no need for one outside of conflict. And as Lisa said, these are full management issues. Second objective here that could be problematic, objective for the activist is often when you start a committee, you're like, well, let's hire a new set of advisors. And right. When you bring in a new set of advisors, you're like, well, you know, I just got hired as financial advisor to this strategy committee. How else am I going to make some money other than if we sell the company? So you get sort of this, you're starting down a bad track and you're bringing in advisors who don't have a history with the company, and it lead to premature moving in new directions that haven't been thought through by the full board. And there's this way of creating cleavages there.
I mean, I've seen settlements where there's a charter for the subcommittee gets to pick their own legal and banking.
Exactly. Advisor. That's very problematic, Ron.
Yeah.
That's terrible, right? Because there's no conflict in what that committee is doing. There's no reason to have to hire new advisors. And it's just a way of trying to do an end run around what already exists. So it's a way of saying, well, we're only putting two new people on the board. But in fact, we're changing the whole game. We're going to change who the consultants are. We're going to change who the advisors are. And in fact, we're basically, even though we only got two directors out of 11, we're going to have two of three on this committee that's going to make all these decisions. So it's a really very dangerous way to enter into a settlement. The one point I'll put in the opposite direction is when you have an activist on the board, sometimes with the industry experts or others that are appointed by the activist, but when you have someone affiliated with the activist on the board, it's very important for management to actively manage that director and meet with that director regularly and not just treat that director like a lot of the non-activist directors. And so sometimes it's worth having, maybe it doesn't have to be done in the form of a committee, but it could be, where you're just going to have a session with maybe the lead director and that activist director on a regular basis to keep that activist on the reservation, right? Because they're out talking to all sorts of people, coming up with ideas that, as I said, don't have the informational advantage that the incumbent board and incumbent executive team and incumbent advisors have. And so you have to meet with them on a much more regular basis than your periodic board meetings before earnings releases. And so that's the one point I don't want folks to neglect when they're bringing in an activist. Yes, it's a bad idea to undermine all the board processes by all of a sudden giving superpowers to some committee when there's no conflict, but don't neglect the activist director. You've got to manage them. You've got to flood them with your knowledge and why you, as the long-term executive, long-term lead director, long-term advisor, know the right way to go.
It's a lot of additional work if the company agrees to put, actually, let's say, a portfolio manager of a well-known activist hedge fund on the board. You got to spend a lot more time with that person explaining the company's point of view.
Yes, and constantly reel them back in. It's like a constant getting them back onto the reservation orbit, whatever metaphor you want to use. It's like a constant. They're very tough.
I will say the flip side to that is really savvy companies are also skilled at putting those people to work for them, because those managers have enormous resources behind them. And so we've seen situations where companies have been really savvy by saying, hey, can you help us with this thing we're thinking through? Not a consultant, not anyone else, but give them a room to paint while the board continues to build the house, and have them come back and really utilize them and incorporate them that way.
That's interesting. So you have the activist manager actually do a ton of work because they have the resources to look at a particular situation.
Yeah. It's not dissimilar to when a private equity guy does a pipe investment. Mm-hmm. And they often have a service agreement where they get a lot of confidential information through their director and then study it and come back with some white papers with their ideas. But you know, if you're dealing with the real information, not with fantasy stuff that the consultant's coming up with, you really have management managing the information flow. It's much easier to get everybody rowing in the same direction.
No, that's very interesting. I just want to note that I was reading the other day about a subcommittee that had brought on two activist-backed directors. And I did a big of digging into the kind of ancient history bit. I found that another one of the directors on the subcommittee was put there by a previous activist hedge fund. Right. Three out of four were activists. So Now activist-backed directors, I'm not saying, you know, these people aren't their own independent people, but that are, if they're outside people that are put on the board and on these subcommittees. But three out of four of the directors were backed by activists. And I'm sure the second activist knew that other guy was put there by the first activist, if that makes any sense. But okay, I wanted to switch to another one of my favorite subjects, and it sounds like something that you guys are eager to talk about as well, and that is controlled companies. Either those whose founder owns super voting shares, think Mark Zuckerberg, giving him or her control of a majority of votes, or those where an individual, also usually a founder or two, control a majority of the outstanding shares. So either, you know, these dual class share structure companies, or just situations where, you know, one insider owns a majority of shares, or even, you know, an insider owns 40% of shares. I consider that to be essentially controlling. So anyways, I wanted to note that Jeff Smith, the activist investor, told the Council of Institutional Investors last year that, quote, if an insider controls 52% of the vote, I can yell until I'm blue in the face and provide as many choices as I want, and they don't have to listen. But despite what Jeff Smith said, I've seen a bunch of cases where the activist has been successful at getting a director on an insider-controlled board, or otherwise have been successful in their campaign, such as Blackwell's campaign at Peloton, for example, not too long ago. So I guess, Ethan, maybe we could start with you on this. Do controlled companies have to worry about activists, or can they just say, we don't have to even think about them?
Well, remember, every board is only as strong as the actual human beings that serve as a majority of the board, who even with a controlled company are typically independent folks. And nobody likes to be criticized publicly. Nobody likes to be recommended against by ISS, even if they are going to be elected by virtue of the controlling shareholders' super votes. So I think one very important factor to keep in mind is we're dealing with human beings, right? And nobody likes to be attacked. And so that's a very important reason why a lot of what we do on activist preparedness for a company that's non-controlled, we've seen the benefits of that backbone building exercise, which primarily consists of really buying into the standalone strategic plan, understanding it, understanding what institutional shareholders think, trying to be involved in the messaging to those shareholders. The whole shareholder engagement strategy is important for controlled companies because even if you control the company as the controlling shareholder, you're still potentially have a vulnerability in that your board is populated with mere mortals who can be subject to criticism and then start raising ideas of, well, maybe we should take some seats and let them be elected by the low vote shares, or maybe we should terminate our high vote, low vote structure early, or set a sunset date, or maybe we shouldn't extend the dual class structure. A number of dual classes are at risk of collapsing in the next few years. And a lot of companies, a lot of controlling shareholders, as well as a lot of their shareholders, would like to see the high vote, low vote continue to make sure there's stability and that the long-term plan is protected. And so we're talking to a number of clients about the idea of extending sunsets of high vote, low vote structures. Meanwhile, you have activists coming in and saying, you should collapse the high vote, low vote structure. And that can be done through reclassification transaction, where typically a premium is paid to the high vote shares for agreeing to convert their high vote shares into low vote. And the idea is that, well, even though you're paying a premium, so they're not necessarily converting in a one-to-one basis, but let's say 1.3.5 shares for every one share held by the high vote, there's still going to be some uplift to the share price for everybody, even though there's some dilution based on the way the reclassification is structured. So my point here is, Ron, there's a lot of optionality with high vote, low vote structures and controlling shareholders to rejigger the architecture so that you either extend the control or you diminish the control. And at the same time, the guys who are ultimately in the boardroom talking about all this are not exclusively the controlling shareholder. And I think they are vulnerable to criticism, and that activists have really honed their messaging to make that criticism as painful and hurtful to and effective as possible.
Okay, so there's a lot of things that I want to unpack from the comments you're making that are really, really interesting. I guess, you know, on the one hand, I feel like I see situations where these activists, like I was following this one situation involving the activist Diane McKeever at IDES Capital that drove a company to collapse, essentially. Its insider-controlled share structure. It was an unusual situation, that one with the director had the controlling vote, not the founder or CEO. But what you said, Ethan, about so companies can actually extend the dual class. Let's say companies that at their IPO have agreed that after, let's say, 7 or 10 years, they will sunset their dual class structure. They're coming upon the sunset date, and there are ways that companies can actually extend the sunset. So instead of, you know, sunsetting in 2024, they'll sunset in 2030 or something. Or how would that work exactly?
Yeah, I mean, the main what we're seeing most is a lot of companies that IPO'd several years ago had sunsets that are triggered by the high vote shares representing at least a minimum percentage, typically 10% of the outstanding shares of both of all classes. And the idea would be to lower that percentage to a lower number. And so even though the high vote shares are only 6% of the outstanding shares, instead of having to be above 10% of all the outstanding shares, that they would still remain high vote.
So they would still have a large percentage of the control, maybe not as much as before. Is that?
No. I think they'd still have the same control because the difference is that they wouldn't automatically collapse into low vote.
To be perfectly honest, we have a watch list and a crosshairs list of companies we think could be targeted soon by an activist. And we look at the sunset dates.
Yeah.
We have a lot of them. And like, for example, Twilio is this one company.
Yeah.
In the midst of collapsing dual class, and lo and behold, the activist shows up. You know, saying, okay, you know, basically the company had not faced an activist, as far as I know, before the decision to collapse the dual class.
Virtually every company that has voluntarily collapsed their high vote, low vote, or that had their high vote, low vote expire as a result of a sunset date has been hit with activism within a year or less after the collapse. And that's very persuasive for boards saying, you know what? I know it's not popular with Council of Institutional Investors, et cetera, but maybe it's really good for us because we could sit here and not be distracted by any kind of short-termism.
Right. Or be forced to sell the company.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't have a lot of time. So I wanted to get through at least maybe one, possibly two more topics. Lisa, I'm wondering if you think that activists really want board seats anymore, particularly for independent directors. And wondering what you think they get out of the outside directors getting on the board. And I've seen a bunch of situations where activists have put on outside directors on a board, maybe even on a subcommittee, and the company does a review of like whether they should sell a division, and they conclude that they want to keep the division intact, and the activists did not get what they accomplished. So I feel like it often backfires for them when the activist puts outside candidates on boards, even if they pick them themselves. So is this something that you have a view on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's something that, and it goes back to your question on why would an activist go after a controlled company? I mean, it's kind of an open secret that the desire for board seats is just not as strong as it once was. It is more difficult for activists to put their own principles on the board because then they are subject to things like insider trading, and the director is subject to fiduciary duties, and there are conflicts and other issues that have to be worked through that can actually limit the activist's ability to do what it wants with respect to the shares. And so that wasn't always working. And so then there was this move to put independent directors on, and this isn't either or, but kind of how the trends are moving. Then there was this move to put independent directors on. And the little known secret for a lot of these is that an activist will often come to a company and say, you need some new blood. And the board will say, we don't disagree that we need new blood. And the board says to the activist, who do you have in mind? And the activist turns to the board and says, who do you have in mind? And the board ends up picking its new independent directors with sign off and credit to the activist. And in that world, there's a question about why an activist even then needs to have someone on the board if what it really wants in, as we said, half of situations is for the company to sell itself or to do a buyback or to relook at its capital allocation, does it actually need a director to do that? Does it need to go through the processes and the cost and the pain of trying to get a director on the board? Or can they do this through outside mechanisms, through outside pressure, for all the reasons that Ethan was talking about, that no one wants to be criticized from internally or externally? So can't we just do it that way?
I mean, in a way, Ron, it's basically, it's the only, how many weapons or strategic resources does a shareholder have, right? So I don't know. I agree with Lisa that getting someone on the board, whether it's your own guy or someone else, doesn't necessarily change everything, but it's your only threat. So it's like, you really want to rob the house, but the only thing you could do is break the lamp that's outside the front door. So that's all you can do. That's your threat. And so you go about it. You know, there's not so many strategic resources that are available to shareholders. You can't legislate as a shareholder what the company is going to do strategically or operationally, because it's a board-centric system we have. So threatening the board is really the only vehicle that's available. And sometimes I think it's rather symbolic and going to this point of saying, I'm going to embarrass you if you don't do what I want, as opposed to really trying to, because it's very rare to try and take over the whole board. One other point I just want to throw out that we've been doing for a while and now is coming more into fashion is, instead of putting new folks on the board at all, you enter into what we call as information sharing agreements, where at the discretion of the company and the activists, from time to time, the activist receives material non-public information, and then there's arrangements about how long that information will remain material non-public information, because obviously whenever the activist touches it, they're not allowed to trade. And so we do those types of arrangements regularly on behalf of clients. And depending on the terms, because the terms can vary widely, they can be a very effective means of neutralizing the activist without creating a lot of disruption in the boardroom.
Yeah, and I've seen situations where there's the activist has ability to kind of watch or participate in the board meeting, but isn't actually a director. I feel like, and then there's an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, where the activist gets access to information as part of that kind of scenario. But I haven't seen much of that lately. But that's interesting, giving the activist access to non-public inside information, but of course, you know, restricting them on, if they can't trade on it, basically, is quite interesting. And it's an interesting strategy. And, you know, about the boards and the activist putting outside directors on boards, I actually was speaking to a executive search guy that works only with activists. And he said that the activists typically try to find their own outside directors, but a lot of times the deadline is coming up and aren't able to find the right person. And so they go to the executive search. And the guy told me that they look for people that will try to do the things the activist wants, and also that they're people that are persuasive. And he tries to find people that would be persuasive on the boards. So I don't know how successful he is, but I agree with you. I've seen a lot of situations where activists put outside directors on the board and they have not had, or it's been a, you know, mutually agreed upon directors, when in reality the company is picking the director and it looks like the activist has a lot of influence, but really they don't have a lot of influence. But I don't know. I wonder how much influence, you know, whether these outside directors are really a Trojan horse coming in and pressuring the company to do something, or they're really independent directors. I feel like more often than not, they're independent directors that have no allegiance to the activist. I think we are out of time, and you've been listening to the Activist Investor Today podcast. And I was speaking with Ethan Klinsberg and Elizabeth Bieber of Freshfields. Ethan, Elizabeth, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, it's always great to talk about this stuff, because it's really important for companies, and both in the executive teams and in the boardroom, to understand how the tactics work for the activists and to be prepared, because there are ways to say no and to preserve the integrity of the company's internal processes.
Okay, thanks, Ethan. And thank you, Lisa, for taking the time too. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob.